when we look at hope, for example, as a motivating emotion, when we see other people acting in ways that are meaningful, it helps us to stay doing something even when it's really hard to do. People may think I'm saying, oh, you have to be happy all the time, joyful, and, you know, skip and that sort of thing. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that we all have a diversity of emotions and feelings around these real issues, and we need safe spaces to name them and feel them.
How do we keep pushing for a change that we know is right when it seems like that change is so far away, so impossible to achieve? How can we be realistic about what we can achieve without giving in to the inevitability of the status quo, to the rightness it whispers in our ear, the futility it seeks to impress on us at every turn? How do we hope without that hope being a platitude? Welcome to the very first episode of the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. This podcast is about radical change. It is based on a simple premise that a radically changed world may be much closer than we think. Now, I know this is a tricky premise. It's hard to believe. It's hard to have hope. Sometimes hope can be challenging. Sometimes hope can be a platitude, the opiate of the masses. There are some pretty horrible and discouraging things going on in the world. Racism seems like it's on the rise. Nationalism, prejudice, greed, they all seem like they're getting worse, not better. But here's the thing. When systems change, they often exhibit much more extreme behavior right before a major threshold is passed. So while it can be discouraging to see people so polarized, so disconnected from one another, to see erosions of women's rights and of voting rights, my gut tells me that these are signs that we're close, not far away, from a radically changed world. So that's why we're here. To take a look at the major movements and changes unfolding in the world around us and see if we can glimpse what a radically changed future will entail. What does prosperity look like without growth? What do safety and justice look like without policing? What does North America look like after indigenous peoples get their lands back? I think that seeing the tangible possibilities on the other side of these major movements can help us better recognize the work that is already underway. To get us started, I'm talking this week with Ellen Kelsey. Ellen is the author of Hope Matters, Why Changing the Way We Think is Critical to Solving the Environmental Crisis. Ellen and I talk about the crisis of hope, about how to make hope evidence-based. We talk about the starting line fallacy, and then we talk about how youth are turning social movements on their ends. This was a really great discussion. Let's dig in. Today, for this inaugural episode of the Second Transition Podcast, I have the very great pleasure of talking with Ellen Kelsey. Ellen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'd like to start this conversation for this first episode of the podcast with a quote from early in your book. You write, "There should never be just one dominant story. In a well-functioning democratic world, there are multiple stories competing with one another for our attention. The idea that something as complex and extraordinary as all life on Earth could ever be encapsulated by a single grand narrative just doesn't make sense." I really like this quote. Why do you think having a plurality of storylines for life and for humanity's future on this planet is so important?
Thank you so much, and thank you for pulling that quote. Yeah, I think what is magnificent about this planet is we live on a planet with 8.7 million other species, or at least that's the number that's sort of most commonly shared right now. It could be much more, but that's the number that scientists tend to use. And when you think about that, that means there are, you know, infinite things going on at any particular time, you know, and we know the longer that we look at what other species are doing, we see cultures within the same species, we see seasonality, we see, you know, the expression of intergenerational resilience, you know, so we know we live on a dynamic planet in terms of the natural ecosystem that we are all part of. And I think we're certainly living in a time where we're recognizing the incredible diversity of people within the planet as well. And so the point I'm trying to make is that when we think about, you know, what's happening, this just one narrow idea that everything was good and now it's wrecked, you know, this doom and gloom narrative, that just can't be an accurate, fulsome story. And when you're trying to make social change, which we're all very interested in right now in this time of COVID, this time of climate change, that we know that we're strongest when we have people working all along a spectrum, those who are really calling out the alert, those who have already embedded those changes as values that are just lived ethics, you know? And so it's the diversity of response. And we see it if we think about gender equality rights, for example, if we look at that as a movement, movements become much stronger when there's a diversity of voices, there's a diversity of contexts, there's a diversity of histories, then we can place ourselves within them and become really very strong activists or take action within whatever position feels right for our own identities.
Now, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that there are no panaceas. So many people seem so caught up in finding the one solution, the one silver bullet, but really the solutions to the problems that we're facing are tied up in all manner of local circumstances and nuances and culture and values. Am I getting it right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it really, I often speak with groups of people and they'll say, please tell us the three things I should be doing, that sort of idea. And we can certainly look in our history of environmental action. We would communicate the 10 best things or that. And there are lots of examples of those that are fulsome and worth looking at. You know, we know that switching to a plant-based diet is a really positive thing to do. And many people are, in fact, already doing that. It's a very large trend around the world. So those are not bad questions to ask. But I think where they get maybe miss the point a little bit is that if we look at groups like one that I'm very interested in right now is the Intersectional Environmentalist Council, which is a group of social influencers who are coming at this from their own positionality, their own identity. So there's a wonderful person who self-identifies as a drag queen in Australia who's interested in climate change messaging. That person is going to communicate to a group of people who will identify with that person in a way that may not identify with, you know, a scientist speaking about the top three things. And so I think it's when we come with our own full identities, our own unique qualities, the things we do, even if people say, you know, why are you still doing that thing? It's something you're passionate about. Then we embed these practices in ways that are just truly us. And we speak to others. I really love the urban birding movement, for example, that's sweeping the planet right now. That's an exciting movement because it's people at home in their own place, recognizing, you know, the joy of birding. And there's been ongoing studies that show that when somebody becomes an urban birder and becomes involved in that way, they're much more likely to notice environmental things happening around their city and then to take action around those things in their own city where they probably have much more influence than they would on some, you know, top four things that are generalized and not specific to their place. So I really do think that plurality is the important part of it, is finding our own things that drive us.
It strikes me too that what you're saying really upends how we think about leadership and makes addressing environmental and social problems much more of a collective task and much less about waiting for the hero, waiting for the one savior, the often white male savior who is going to swoop in with their money and their technology and their solutions to solve these problems for us. You're talking about something very different.
Maybe just to add on to that, I think when we look at hope, for example, as a motivating emotion, we know that collective hope is quite powerful, that when we see other people acting in ways that are meaningful, it helps us to stay doing something even when it's really hard to do. So being part of a collective is very motivating. And even when we think of narratives, you know, this some people talk about the grim, dark narrative, which we see in lots of dystopian films and books and all those kind of things around climate change. And then there's the noble, bright narrative, which is that one shining hero who will save us. And I think we've used that a lot in environmental communication. And then there's one called Hope Punk. And in that narrative, it's the idea that we as members of bigger communities act in the way that we think is the right way forward around this. And even if we don't believe we're going to have a positive impact, which I do believe and I'm seeing, that's what drives us, is this belief in acting in the ways that we know to be right in terms of, tackling the difficult issues ahead of us. So it is, Hope Punk is a collective narrative, whereas Noble, Bright, and Grim Dark are individualistic.
Okay, so I need to diverge here for a minute and talk about Hope Punk. Alexandra Rowland, author of A Conspiracy of Truths and A Choir of Lies, coined the phrase. They offer it as an alternative to the grim dark view that we see in everything from The Hunger Games to even Batman. I asked Alexandra if they would read an excerpt from their 2017 essay where they introduce the concept.
So the essence of grimdark is that everybody's inherently sort of a bad person and does bad things, and that's awful and disheartening and cynical. It's looking at human nature and going, the glass is half empty. Hope Punk says, no, I don't accept that. Go fuck yourself. The glass is half full. Yeah, we're all a messy mix of good and bad, flaws and virtues. We've all been mean and petty and cruel, but, and here's the important part, we've also been soft and forgiving and kind. Hope Punk says that kindness and softness doesn't equal weakness, and that in this world of brutal cynicism and nihilism, being kind is a political act, an act of rebellion. Hope Punk says that genuinely and sincerely caring about something, anything, requires bravery and strength. Hope Punk isn't ever about submission or acceptance. It's about standing up and fighting for what you believe in. It's about standing up for other people. It's about demanding a better, kinder world and truly believing that we can get there if we care about each other as hard as we possibly can with every drop of power in our little hearts.
As a mission statement, Hope Punk is pretty awesome. But at the same time, there is worry that hope can be a platitude. Now, I brought this up to Ellen, which leads us to a discussion of evidence-based hope, something that Ellen spends a lot of time on in her book.
Yeah, I think often we use hope and wishing interchangeably. So we say, we hope this will happen. And that has this wishful thinking quality. And I personally think that when Greta Thunberg is speaking out against hope.
You're referring to her speech at Davos, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Let's have a quick listen to what she said.
Adults keep saying, we owe it to the young people to give them hope. But I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act. I want you to act as if you would in a crisis. I want you to act as if the house was on fire, because it is.
What I hear her saying, and I don't wish to put words in her mouth, what I hear her saying is she's speaking out against vacuous wishful thinking. But evidence-based hope is hope that is grounded within looking at trends of where things were and where they are now and where they're heading. And so we're really looking at, okay, how much protected areas are there on land and in the ocean now? Where were they in the past? And how close are we getting to these new goals, which are out there now around establishing 30% of land and ocean by 2030, so that's a very ambitious goal and one that I find really hopeful, because it wasn't long ago that I worked on a marine protected area strategy to try and convince former George Bush to establish what was then the world's largest marine protected area back in 2008 as his final act of leaving office. And at that point, there was very little of the ocean was protected, very, very little, small percentage points. And in fact, we were successful as a much broader initiative. And George Bush did declare what was then the world's largest marine protected area. And it's something like now the 12th largest. And so just within, you know, that last decade, we see a real movement towards ecosystem scaled marine protected areas. Now, there are issues with them and how well they're protected and all of those kind of things. But that movement is a really important example of an evidence-based shift. And now this goal of 30% by 2030. Again, we have to work hard to get to it. It's fraught with challenges. But the fact remains that we're moving from a few percentage points to 30 percentage points within a, you know, less than a 20-year time frame. So that's an exciting shift that's evidence-based.
And that's a fast shift too.
A fast shift, exactly. And I think where I find this to be so important is that when we know that the number one way that most people learn about the environment is through the media, and that almost all of the media that we hear about the environment is in a problem identification frame. So we hear what is broken and almost nothing is about what is actually happening. It's helpful to know that, because then you say, oh, I'm actually missing, you know, the other half of the story, which is, and that's where fields like solution journalism are so important, I think, because that network of journalists from all over the world has been in the last decade actively saying we need to look just as rigorously at solutions as we do at problems.
By not looking at possible solutions, we're just convincing people these problems are too big to solve, that they're too intractable, that individual actions can't help, that civic action can't help.
Exactly. And it doesn't tell us anything about the solution. Tony Lieseritz, who's at Yale University, he talks about this hope gap that we have, where what we've really seen in recent time is a big movement of people who now really know about climate change and are really concerned about it. The challenge we now have isn't that people don't know and aren't concerned. It's that there's this gap in a belief that there's anything they can do about it. And if you don't believe there's anything you can do about it, then that's very disempowering. And there were just two massive studies that came out just last month looking at youth under the age of 25. And one of them, looking across 10 countries, found that the majority of those youth in that age group, three out of four, believe that there's nothing we can do about this climate crisis. That is a really powerful and problematic issue that we have, that I think is as big a problem as climate change itself, is that we're disempowering, by focusing so much on the problems only, those people who are most engaged in trying to make a change.
And Ellen, it also makes it feel, I think, like all of the work is still ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. And we know that urgency discourses, and something I talk about is this starting line fallacy. We often talk about the environment as, you know, as if all the hard work is ahead and we're just at the starting line if we do this. But when we default to an urgency discourse, we know that urgency is tied to fear, and in fear discourses, we tend to get shut down. We don't think collectively. We don't think as creatively. We think more individualistically, all the things we don't want at this particular time. And so I think it really is helpful to say we have an urgent issue and look at the kinds of things we are doing that we want to amplify.
And you talk about needing to make solutions crave-worthy.
I'm so glad you brought up that idea of crave-worthy, because it's people at the Stanford University has a mind-body lab that looks at the power of mindset. And Aaliyah Crum, the person who has led the mind-body lab, was looking at our good intentions of trying to get people to eat healthy vegetables. Mm-hmm. That's the example she used. We know they're good for us, but we're not choosing them. But when they were recast in a way that those healthy vegetables sounded yummy and crave-worthy, then people are much more likely to take them up. So you're quite right. That craving is such a big part. And I do think that we're definitely seeing movements around people's capacity, you know, around cities since COVID has hit. Cities have been really leapfrogging ahead with this idea of walkable cities, or bikeable cities, or pedestrian first cities, which we know are really important from a air pollution situation. And air pollution is one of those ones that's very fast. Reports show that, you know, within 48 hours of changing car patterns, we see positive, very positive health benefits across populations. It's a very quick response. And so, and we know that there's actually around cities that have closed off their city centers to cars. The big concern was around people would not go into shops, but in fact, they shop more, you know, so these sort of movements that allow us to move at a pace that is right for our bodies, you know, a walkable way has all these environmental benefits. It has community benefits. It has these sort of things. So repositioning this thinking about how we move in cities and how cities being for people first is an important initiative for all kinds of things that we crave. And it has these very positive impacts for climate change and positive impacts for air pollution and other things.
So earlier you brought up youth, and I think if we want to look to examples that we want to amplify, youth is where we should look. But an interesting thing about your book is that while so many people today, it seems, lament youth and talk about all the things they're doing wrong or not doing the way that the boomers did, your book takes a very different approach to thinking about youth and proposes, I think, that there's quite a paradigm change in how they see themselves and the world and environmental problems. Can you tell me about that?
There's been, in the recent years, these student guides to the climate crisis that have been created by university-age students often, or sometimes high school students. And some of the things you see in there are a real focus on things like communal care and allyship and how we look after each other and self-care and these sorts of qualities, which we know are important to our own personal resilience. And so labeling them right in that guide as equally as important as understanding what's happening around ozone layers or climate change problems, you know? And I think that recognition of our emotional well-being as is really being driven by the climate justice movement, which is how youth see climate change. They are asking for a transformation, not for sustainability, but for transformation, which is a justice-oriented movement. And your earlier point, which is we tend to misunderstand people of different generations. We certainly know millennials were the first big demographic where we were able to say people are very involved in the environment, but not in the way it looked for older generations. So not joining environmental organizations, for example, but heartily engaging in activities in their own local communities, and then switching to another activity in their own local communities that matters to them, where they can see meaningful change. And so it's I think this requirement to not stay stuck in, you know, this thing doesn't always look this way, but what's now actually happening, you know? Right. So it's an openness of mind to what's the impact? What are people actually engaged with? Rather than saying, oh, how many people have joined environmental organizations and that's declining, so therefore they must not be interested in the environment.
Right. And you've almost really brought us full circle here to something we were talking about at the top of the show, and that's the plurality, and that instead of, you know, looking at these new ways of engaging and thinking of them as wrong or not the right strategy, let's revel in the plurality of all of the different ways and modes that people are engaging with these problems. And let's work with that. Let's amplify that. Now, Ellen, as my first guest on this podcast, you're the first person who's going to answer this question, but I plan on asking a version of this question to everybody that joins us. And that is, what is the most radical change that you would like to see in your lifetime? And are we getting there?
Oh boy, that's a beautiful question. I think that we put in place ideas around the Anthropocene, which is this idea of a geological period in which humans are the first time one species is a dominant force on causing global change. And the naming of the Anthropocene is a very powerful thing in order to hold us accountable as people. One of the unintended consequences, I think, of that is it can reinforce this great chain of being where humans are at the top and everybody else is kind of underneath. And that's really in opposition to how I see the world and the radical change I want to see, which is this ecosystem worldview where we are one species amongst 8.7 million others, all of which are vibrant and active and have agency. And so the most radical change I would like to see is that ecosystem worldview where we recognize the culture of other species, their agency, that when we put in place better protection so that other species can thrive, mm-hmm. that we are in fact voting on behalf of our greater connection, you know, that we are just nature And that is undeniable. You and I are only breathing thanks to those phytoplankton. And so we have a very vested interest in the ocean, and that ocean is taking care of us, whether or not we know it. So I think that's the most radical change, is that we know it in ourselves and in our bodies. We are nature, but we often behave as if we think we're on a human-only world, and that doesn't serve us.
And with that, I want to thank you for listening to this inaugural episode of the Second Transition Podcast. The Second Transition Podcast is produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northern California. Funding for this podcast comes in part from the Errol Food Institute, from the University of Guelph, and from Voice Ed Radio. My guest today was Ellen Kelsey, author of Hope Matters. You can find her contact information, social media details, and how to buy the book on the website. Thanks also to Alexandra Rowland for reading to us some of their words on Hope Punk. Stay tuned for new episodes every 2 weeks. Joining us next episode is Jamie Beck Alexander, director of Drawdown Labs. Jamie and I will dig deep into the future of the private sector. How do we leverage their great positioning to affect change while avoiding the deception and predatory delay that seems to be the modus operandi of so many private sector firms? I really can't wait for this one. See you next time.